You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, and boy, there's a lot going on in the world that we are going to be getting to through the 3 hours of our program today. But I want, and in fact, in our third hour, we're going to get into, is Rupert Murdoch really willing to lie, cheat, and steal his way to power, and what has happened in the United States? Our second hour, is libertarianism dead? I've got a pretty good rant on that. I think you'll like. I spent a lot of time on it this morning. And to open the show, John Nichols, Tony Tripiano is going to be with us also from Michigan to give us an update on what's going on there. So, but John Nichols with The Nation, the Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, thenation.com, the website, on the line with us. Hey, John, welcome.
Tom, it's just great to be with you. We speak on a momentous day.
I understand that there was... why is it momentous?
We've got some remarkable new poll numbers.
Oh, I was just going to say, I understand there's a new poll out, and then I thought, well, wait a minute, maybe it's okay, go for it.
Yeah, I know, usually when we get poll numbers, we open them a bit cautiously and with concern. Mm-hmm. But as you know, because you've reported so well, not just on Wisconsin, but on these state-based struggles across the country, these governors who have adopted austerity measures have really killed out job growth, and it's been quite devastating. And Wisconsin's had a lot of headlines over the last couple of weeks about Governor Walker's devastating impact on job creation. We have the new poll out that just came, and for the first time in quite a while, the poll shows that of the voters, among registered voters, Governor Walker now trails his leading Democratic challenger, that's Tom Barrett. And also, it shows that for the first time, voters in Wisconsin have, by rapidly increasing numbers, come to the conclusion that Democrats do a better job of creating jobs than Republicans, which is a very, very big deal. What it suggests is, and it gets you to the bottom line, and I know you've got a lot of listeners, not just in Wisconsin, but around the country who follow the fight there, there is a very real chance that this governor, Scott Walker, will be defeated in the June 5th election. It doesn't mean for sure he will be,
right,
but this pattern of poll numbers is very positive.
Well, that's a good sign. John, yesterday was the Occupy the World Day. It was May Day. And
absolutely.
And you've written and in fact did a nice little video piece for The Nation about the impact of citizens' movements and activist. I'm getting redundant, activist activities and things like that. Give us a history lesson on this.
Well, I'll do the best I can. Look, you know this very well, Tom, and I think your listeners do from being, you know, part of the community that's been built around this show. The way that progressives have won, the way that progressives have moved things forward in America is by combining activism in the streets with a smart approach to electoral politics, not doing one versus the other. Unfortunately, in recent decades, by and large, although not completely, an awfully lot of progressives kind of started to lean more and more toward a confidence in electoral politics and sometimes in the courts to deliver the progress they wanted. And as we well know, we have not had a lot of progress of late on a lot of fronts. One of the things that's been incredibly positive over the last year and a half, and some would trace it even back to the mid-2000s where the immigrant rights movement went to the streets, but especially in the last year and a half, as labor and progressive activists, particularly young people, have gone to the streets and made aggressive demands as regards labor rights, the rights of workers, and really a vision for a fairer society. They've begun to change a lot of the dynamics, and they're not doing something new. In many senses, they are returning to a tried and true formula. So yesterday, I was a very, very happy man because I watched across the United States as particularly young people, but also backed up by unions, brought the Occupy movement back into the streets in a major way, in significant numbers. And that's what we need. We cannot just, you know, wait for some election down the line to deliver us. We've got to be activists, physically active, if we're going to see the kinds of real change and real shift in the debate that I think a lot of us want.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Scott Walker and Chris Christie and the John Doe probe, tell me about this.
This is the opposite of Occupy, isn't it? Chris Christie flew out to Wisconsin to campaign for Scott Walker on Occupy Day. I guess Christie wanted to get as far as
yesterday.
New York and New Jersey as he could. They're far from it. So he came out to Wisconsin, and he took, if you can believe it, Occupy rhetoric and tried to turn it around and have it be on the side of Scott Walker. Chris Christie said that the fight in Wisconsin, the recall battle that we are talking about, is really a fight between the will of the people and the special interests. And, of course, Christie was suggesting the special interests are, you know, working people and their unions. But the comedy of his statement was that he made it on the very day that it was revealed that Scott Walker had raised $13 million, more than any candidate for governor has ever raised in the history of the state, not over the course of a whole campaign, but in the course of one campaign finance quarter, 1 3-month period, raised $13 million, and that 74% of his contributors were from outside Wisconsin, not inside Wisconsin. And so you saw here Christie trying to play some sort of populist card ends up actually being on exactly the wrong side of it. And then to add insult to injury or comedy, perhaps, Chris Christie said that he was supporting Scott Walker because Scott Walker was a good and decent and honorable man. But at almost precisely the same time that Chris Christie was uttering those words, it was being revealed that Scott Walker's campaign had quietly shifted $60,000 over to help fund Scott Walker's criminal defense fund to combat a John Doe probe into campaign and official corruption.
Amazing. Amazing. So where's
better than that, does it?
Where is that going to go, by the way?
That John Doe probe is a very real, very big deal. It still has not begun to reach its full level of significance. There have been 5 aides to the governor and campaign donors to the governor who have been charged with significant crimes. Mm-hmm. 14 felony indictments have been brought forward. But the fact is that that investigation continues. There's going to be a lot more developing on it. And what we know is that in addition to $60,000 going into the governor's criminal defense fund, which will pay for, he's hired 2 of the top criminal defense lawyers in the upper Midwest. His campaign also revealed that it had spent $170,000 on 2 other law firms that are also trying to defend the campaign itself on charges related to, at least on some charges related to the John Doe probe.
Amazing.
So there's a lot blowing up there, and in almost all of it, circles back to real questions about what did the governor know and when did he know it.
And who did he get his money from and what was the agenda?
Right.
It's like, you know, whose toady is he? You know, is he working for the people or is he working for the billionaires? And if so, which billionaires and what specifically did they want? It's just amazing. John Nichols with The Nation. TheNation.com is the website. John, thanks a lot for dropping by.
I am delighted to be with you, Tom. You've done such a good job on this story.
Thank you. Always great talking with you. John Nichols with The Nation. 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be back in just a few minutes. Oh, by the way, if you're in Washington, D.C., this Sunday, May 6th, we're going to have truthout.org is going to have a fundraiser. I'll tell you all about that just as we come back for the next break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour, and we're going to check in with Tony Tripiano in Detroit in just a moment. 20 minutes past the hour. And let us not melt down on these odd days. Let us all, okay. Oh my, it's an interesting time. In the state of Michigan, I mentioned I was going to tell you about this fundraiser. This is just an FYI. If you're in the Washington D.C. area, if you're going to be on this weekend, Dina Racer and Gar Alperovitz are going to be joining me on May 6th at 5 p.m. here in Washington D.C. at the Tabard Inn for a fundraiser for TruthOut.org. And tickets for Truth Out donors are $25. They're $40 for non-donors, general admission. If you would like to know more about that, email rsvp@truthout.org. Tony Trupiano on the line with us. Tony is the host of First Shift with Tony Trupiano on WDTW, our Detroit affiliate, and his website, thetonyshow.org. Tony, big stuff. First of all, welcome back to the program.
Well, my brother, it's always a pleasure to be with you. I'm enjoying the new time slot, by the way. It's just better for my schedule because I actually get to listen to all 3 hours of you now. So thank you for being kind enough to accommodate me.
It's an honor, Tony, and thanks for listening. It is always an honor to have you on the program and a pleasure. Tell me, from my old home state, I got an email from my brother Steve, who used to be a political consultant in Michigan, on some of the wacky stuff that's going on in this in Michigan. What's up with Rick Snyder right now?
Well, just very quickly, let me start where maybe we'll end up. We have a rally this Saturday at the state capitol for another effort to recall Governor Rick Snyder, but we have a really dangerous situation here with regard to respect for democracy. Legislation that is so unkind. Tom, since the first of the year, just from the first of the year, 90 pieces of anti-worker legislation. A couple hours from now, I'm going to actually be speaking at the American Federation of Teachers, Michigan, political roundtable to discuss what these legislators have been doing to our educators and our education system. It's careening out of control to a point where what I see here, and I've lived here my entire life, is not recognizable as democracy. It's not recognizable as leadership. It's not recognizable as sanity or logic or any of those things that you might expect to happen by accident once in a while aren't happening at all. And then there's a deliberate effort, I think, to dumb down the electorate here. And I'm happy to tell you that it's actually empowering a lot of people. But, wow, this feels more like work than it ever has.
Yeah. Well, ever since Rachel Maddow really kind of blew this thing out, this passing immediately in violation of the state constitution and stuff, is this going to – first of all, what's happening with that? Let me just ask you that.
All right, well, what you're referencing is something called immediate effect. I'm happy to tell you, although the legislation that passed – yesterday, which unfortunately allows cyber schools to thrive here in the state of Michigan, taking more money out of public education and giving it to companies like K-12 Incorporated, which are getting extremely wealthy and profiting off taxpayer dollars. I am happy to tell you, though, the Republicans in the state legislature realized that they couldn't once again just roll over immediate effect, so they did take a roll call vote. They were able to slow this legislation down, which really means at the end of the day that although the law will happen, it will not happen until March of 2013 instead of immediately. So at least it slows it down a little bit.
But what about all these laws that were passed illegally? I mean, isn't there a legal challenge to this?
You and I care about that. I think that people that, there's no legal challenge to it. I mean, individually, some of these bills are being challenged, but you're relying on really organized labor and other activist organizations to spend money, Tom, out of their pockets to fight this stuff in court. It just doesn't happen for free. You've got to have the money to fight it, and some of this stuff just can't be fought. There's no money there.
Wow. Wow, that's incredible. I'm astounded that the National Democratic Party, at the very least, wouldn't be saying, or some national group wouldn't be saying democracy's dying in Michigan. These people are, I mean, this is an autocracy what these people are doing.
I'm telling you, for people like me that actually take the time and read this legislation and understand what it does and care about the Constitution and work hard for those things that just protect basic, you know, rights in the state and in the country, to see what's happening now is very, very difficult. But again, we can't give up, and I'm hoping that we're going to have a huge turnout on Saturday at the state capitol as a show of force, so that they understand that we, you know, again, as a block, we are a group to be recognized. We are a force to be listened to.
Yeah, let's make that very clear. This event is going to be Saturday, May 5th. At the United States, or at the Lansing, at the state capitol, Michigan State Capitol, at 2 p.m. it starts. Do I have that right?
Yep, 2 p.m. Michigan Rising is the name of the nonpartisan group that is sponsoring this event. They were nice enough to ask this partisan to show up and help them to do it. We are going to be streaming live, by the way, and if people go to thetonyshow.org, we'll be doing it right from there. A lot of other sites. We'll be streaming the event, and very much looking forward to kicking this campaign into gear. Again, we're really ramping up now. We had the State Democratic Party, Tom, had their fundraiser Saturday night, their big annual fundraiser, and ran into a lot of people that are passionate about issues, people that I normally wouldn't expect to be getting engaged, activists. I'm very involved in the Occupy movement here and the 99% Spring movement here, so there's a lot of great stuff going on. We now need to turn this action into something real, and I think that we're on the path to doing that.
I'm still stunned, Tony. I just took it for granted that the immediate effect, the Republicans illegally putting all these laws into immediate effect, would have been immediately blown out as soon as it was outed. I'm just astounded. Well, you keep fighting the good fight there on WDTW, thetonyshow.org, the website, and please, if you're listening in Michigan or anywhere nearby and you can get to Lansing on Saturday at 2 o'clock, show up at the state capitol downtown there at the end of Michigan Avenue. Tony Trupiano, great having you on, Tony.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Sorry about that, Tony. Thanks for being with us. Trickle-down economics, Reaganomics, austerity-nomics, the stuff that they're trying, that they've been preaching, the way to save a nation, the way to save a state is to cut the government. I remember Ronald Reagan? The government is not the solution to your problems. The government is the problem. Right. Well, what's happening in Europe, where they're slashing governments, where austerity has been forced on Spain, Italy, Greece, Portugal, Ireland, and now France, is that in all of those countries, unemployment is going up. Well, gee, if you lay off a bunch of government workers and they no longer have money in their pockets to buy things in the marketplace, everybody from the shopkeepers to the manufacturers are going to lose. This is common sense. But common sense seems to have escaped the libertarians who love austerity. It's mind-boggling. The unemployment rate now is at 10.9% for the 17-nation Eurozone. This is the highest it's ever been. And what it's showing, the libertarian notion that we could just have, one Europe or one world and one currency and one, and forget about independent nation states and individual differences and uniquenesses and languages. Doesn't work. There's a reason why we're wired to be tribal. There's a reason why we're wired to be local. There's a reason why democracy works best from the bottom up, not by technocrats running it from the top down or billionaires. Or transnational corporations, which is basically the libertarian line. What Ron Paul would want is for the entire economy to be managed by the billionaires and by the transnational corporations. I mean, that's the end point of libertarianism. And it's being tried, and it is failing terribly. Now in Spain, you have a 51% unemployment rate among youth under 25 years old. And overall, 24.1% unemployment rate in Spain right now. Spain's unemployment rate during the Great Depression in 1933, Spain's unemployment rate was 23%. It's 24% now. Because at least during the Great Depression, they didn't do this stupid austerity thing. It's just absolutely amazing. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. And Bill in Clifton, New Jersey. Hey, Bill, what's up? Thanks for listening to WWRL.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Money is free speech if you make a sign out of dollar bills, right?
Ha! Okay.
See?
I guess
anyway,
so.
No, what I see is ahead of us, it's money against the people, and we have to win this battle. They can't buy America, these billionaires. And if we defeat them in the Walker election or any of these other things that come up, they're going to realize that spending all this money isn't worth it, and they're going to back off of it.
I don't. Yeah, no, in your dreams. I mean, look at what happened in California in 2010. You had Meg Whitman, who was running for governor. She was the former head of, what was it, eBay, wasn't it? And, in fact, I think, you know, maybe one of the founders or co-creators of it, she's a billionaire or a multi-millionaire. She spent, you know, something like 70 or 80 million bucks of her own money trying to become governor, trying to buy that governorship, unsuccessfully. Jerry Brown, you know, a very, you know, kind of modest, unassuming guy, beat her. Then I believe it was Barbara Boxer was taken on by Carly Fiorina, as I recall, the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, who made so much money for herself by sending tens of thousands of HP jobs over to Asia. And she spent a pile of money, and she didn't win. That, you know, you would think that they would look at that and say, okay, that didn't work. But no, they're doubling down. I am not encouraged by that, Bill. I get what you're saying, but respectfully, I don't think that they're going to give up or go away. Beverly in St. David, Illinois. Hey, Beverly, what's up?
First-time caller. Love your show, sir.
Thank you, Beverly. Thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Well, what's on my mind is I think that you might not know what else is going on in Pennsylvania.
Okay.
On the voter ID law.
Mm-hmm.
Because of religious reasons, the Amish do not have photo IDs. So the Republicans are so dumb that they're cutting off their own voters.
Oh, the Amish vote Republican?
Most of them do, yes, sir.
They're betting that there are more poor people and elderly people and students in Pennsylvania than there are Amish. So they're willing to lose a few Amish in order to Amish Republican voters in order to prevent hundreds of thousands of Democratic voters, you know, urban people who live in big cities, people who are going to university, people who are elderly and no longer drive. To get those people out. But interesting point, Beverly. Thank you for calling and sharing it. Much appreciated. Pat in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Pat, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Two quick things for you. I've got a copy of Eugene Wineski's Double Santa Claus Theory, the original document. If you like, I could send that off to you.
I have it.
Oh, you have it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Secondly, my health insurance just went up. So I would just like to say that for people like me that earn paychecks, with Obamacare, we get covered. But with Republicare, we're either going to go broke or die.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, as the congressman from Florida so eloquently said, you know, rule number one under the Republican plan, don't get sick. Rule number two, if you do get sick, die quickly. It's a terrible thing to say, but you're absolutely right. Pat, thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Kirk in Seattle, listening on Talk 1090. Thanks for calling, Kirk. What's up?
Thanks for having me on, Tom. I just wanted to say that I'm kind of pissed off at the Black Blocker anarchists and the effect they had on the Seattle May Day protest yesterday. This is the second time in the last 12, 13 years, WTO being the first, where unfortunately the message has been sort of hijacked, and a lot of people don't even know what May Day was about yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Black Blockers were saving Alec and the Fox spin machines millions of dollars yesterday by subverting the message. And, you know, I was out in the streets in WTO in 99, and it was exhilarating and just amazing to be out there with 50,000 other people. I guess the saving grace yesterday in Seattle was that the last march was an immigration rights march,
mm-hmm.
and that went off without a hitch until a rainstorm happened. But I guess, you know, you're speaking of Europe and austerity, and this really creates a dangerous vacuum that, unfortunately, in Europe right now, it looks like neo-fascists are stepping in to fill. I don't know if you read, but in Greece,
go ahead.
This really far-right party, anti-immigrant party, runs on a platform of burying landmines at the borders to keep the immigrants out. And,
right.
In Holland, Geert Wilders is a rising star.
Yes, and similarly in Denmark, and similarly the anti-immigrant. Here's why I actually think that that's a good sign. I don't think that I don't like these people, and they're crazies, and they would make lousy leaders, and they're not going to get elected. But they're the Pat Buchanans of Europe. But the reason why I think it's a good thing is because Europe tried this libertarian notion. The whole libertarian idea, the Ayn Rand idea, or the libertarian idea, is no national borders, right? That a nation should not look out for itself, that a government looking out for its own people is a bad thing, that ultimately the only thing that can look out for the interests of the people is the so-called market and the people who control the market, the billionaires and the big corporations. And so what they did in Europe was they said, we're going to drop all barriers to national transportation. Human transportation, and the transportation of capital, goods, or people. So no more tariffs, no more boundaries, and no more immigration. So it used to be if you lived in, for example, Germany and you wanted to move to France, you had to get a permit from France to move there. And, particularly if you wanted to work, you had to get a work permit. Now you can just go. And what has happened is, of course, the people are going from the cheap labor countries to the expensive labor countries where people are freaking out about immigration. And it's sort of the same thing that happened here after Reagan stopped enforcing the in 1982 stopped after he gave amnesty to 5-6 million people who were here in the country illegally. At that point, he stopped enforcing the employer sanctions. And so, employers started employing people, and that wiped out in the United States over the next 30 years the meatpacking industry and the construction industry, among others. And at least as good union jobs, as union positions. And the reason why I think that it's a good thing that people are recognizing this is because national boundaries are important. Countries do need a semi-permeable membrane to protect themselves, both in terms of trade policy and immigration policy. It should be rational and reasonable. I'm not anti-immigrant, but I am pro-government, pro-nations having a say in their own destiny, rather than that destiny being determined by a group of unelected technocrats in Brussels, in the case of the EU, or by a bunch of transnational corporations, in the case of the United States. So am I making sense on this?
Well, can I mention another thing? And that is that in order to beat the Alex, the Koch brothers, the Mellon Scaife family, it's going to take people power. And when you have idiots like Black blocker anarchists doing what they did yesterday, people in the middle can't visualize themselves participating in that.
I agree with you on that. I absolutely do. And this is a substantial concern. This whole idea of a diversity of tactics, in my opinion, comes out of flawed logic and flawed read of history, and it actually hurts efforts. Thank you very much for the call, Kirk, and for listening in Seattle on AM Talk. Talk 1090. It is 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Do you know that 25 of the Fortune 100 corporations paid their CEOs more money last year than they paid in taxes for the roads that they use? With you, and if you're watching us on Free Speech TV, it's the Free Speech TV Fund Drive, and if not, check it out anyway, freespeech.org. Ann Picard is on the line. She is the chairperson for the Portland Area Global AIDS Coalition. The website for that is pagac.org. And Ann, welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. Tell us about World's AIDS Orphan Days and the impact of AIDS on kids around the world.
Sure. And first, before I do that, I just want to say that I was listening to that last piece about immigration. The thing about AIDS and the war on AIDS is this is such a positive thing because countries are working together to make it better for people who are impacted by this disease.
Yes.
So anyway, World AIDS Orphans Day.
And my point to that was that you need countries to do that. You
yeah,
need governments.
Absolutely. And that's just one positive thing countries are doing.
Yeah.
And so I need to say that piece. World AIDS Orphans Day is celebrated every May 7th. And we're talking about it a little bit early. It's not until next week, because here in Portland, we're going to be doing a big event in honor of World AIDS Orphans Day.
Where and when?
It's going to be tomorrow, May 3rd. And if we have any listeners out there who are in the Portland area, it's Thursday, May 3rd, World AIDS Orphans Day. It's taking place from 6 to 9 p.m. at Mercy Corps, which is 45 Southwest Ankeny. And as Tom said, you can go to our website, pagac.org, and you can get all the information.
Okay. And around the world, events that are happening for May 7th for World AIDS Orphans Day?
You know, I can't tell you that. This is one thing we're local about.
Local is good. Local is super good. So, Anne, I wish you the very, very best on this, and thank you so much for coming on and giving it a mention.
Okay. Do you want to know some more about it?
Sure. If you have something more you'd like to share with us, go for it.
Well, I just want to say that the reason it's so important is because it's the one day in the year when we focus on the impact of AIDS on children.
Mm-hmm.
And they really get forgotten about. And so I think it's really important. That's why we do it here. And it's not only those that are impacted, mostly those who have lost their parents. It's also the children who are born. Most of them are born infected with HIV.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the bit we really want to stop. The very best outcome for them is if they grow up being kept alive by drugs, and the worst outcome for most of them is they won't live till their second birthday. So, both those reasons, it's really, really important to do what we can to help children.
Yeah, and let's even take it a step beyond that and work toward a cure for this horrible retrovirus.
Well, absolutely. But in the meantime, one thing that I think we can all work on is for children, 90% of them are infected in the birth process, right, from their mothers. And there is a very simple treatment that pregnant mothers can be given which will stop this happening.
Hmm.
It's called preventing mother-to-child transmission.
Right.
It's very easy. And that is one of the success stories.
Is that because the child gets infected during the birth process because there's some blood in the birth canal kind of thing?
Yeah. The mother, so that's one of the ways you can get infected is in the birth process. And also by breastfeeding that as well.
Oh, that's interesting.
But they can prevent it. And that's why we have so few children with AIDS in the United States and so few AIDS orphans in the United States, because most of them get good care and it can be prevented.
Wow. Wow.
And just a few years ago, only 10% of the pregnant moms, say, in sub-Saharan Africa would be getting that treatment, and so their children were all at risk. Now it's got to 50%, so 50% of the pregnant moms are getting this, and their children should be safe. And that's the good news and the bad news. The good news is it's a lot better, and the bad news is we still have a long way to go.
Ann Pekar with the Portland Area, PA, Global AIDS Coalition, GAC, pagac.org, the website, particularly for our listeners on KPOJ in Portland, but around the country. If you want to know what's going on, if you'd like to replicate this in your community, and you know, here's an entry point. Anne, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure, and for the great work you're doing. It's an honor to have you on. Steve, in Bristol, Virginia, you wanted to push back against my saying that Spain is being devastated by austerity?
Yeah, a couple things. Wasn't their unemployment very high well before they even talked about austerity?
Nothing like it is now. The austerity is what drove up their unemployment. What they had before austerity was they had a debt ratio that the banksters didn't like. And they wanted to say, if you want to stay in the EU, if you want to remain part of this common currency, you've got to get your debt to GDP ratio down. What happened was we had this worldwide financial collapse, which was in large part the result of Phil Graham and his merry little band of libertarian Republicans blowing up the Glass-Steagall Act with Graham Leach Bliley and blowing up any government oversight over the commodities trading and creating these black markets where you had $800 trillion worth of derivatives being traded by banks that didn't even exist before the year 1999. And that blew up the world economy. And when the world economy blew up, Spain's GDP sagged. When their GDP sagged, their debt didn't change. But their debt to GDP ratio did. And it exceeded that the EU allows for their members to maintain their participation with the currency. And as a consequence of that, the response of the EU to Spain was, you have to get your debt down. In other words, you've got to lay off a bunch of government workers. You can't try to grow your way out of this. Instead, you've got to cut your way out of it. And history shows, I mean, this is what Herbert Hoover tried to do from 1929 to 1933 and until March of 1933. And it failed. It failed here miserably here in the United States. And now Spain is trying to do this, and Italy is trying to do it. And all these countries are having this forced upon them by the European Union. And it's devastating them. So, Stephen, that's what's going on. And I know that, you know, everybody would like to say, well, not everybody. I know that the Republicans and the Libertarians would like to say, oh, well, this is because they spent too much money. No, not really. It's because they got hit by a worldwide economic crisis and they were straitjacketed and they didn't have their own currency. Spain should have kept the whatever it was, the real, I think it was. They should have kept their own currency instead of joining the EU. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Just a reminder, if you're going to be in the Washington, D.C. area on Sunday, on the 6th, we're going to have a great time at the Tabard Inn at 6 p.m., excuse me, at 5 p.m. on May 6th, Reimagining a Just Economy. Dina Racer and Gal Alperovitz, Alperovitz and I will be there, and it's a fundraiser for truthout.org. It's a great website. And for information, you can email to rsvp at truthout.org, and they'll send you the whole thing. Okay, I'd like your thoughts on this rant I want to share with you. It kind of all fell together for me this morning. I was thinking about what happened with what's going on in France right now with Sarkozy going down in flames. And, well, let me just lay it out for you. This one world idea, in my opinion, is dead. The libertarian one world notion of so-called free trade and so-called free markets is dead. The biggest problem facing America right now is that our politicians, and particularly our elite media, don't yet realize that it's dead. But for millennia, starry-eyed idealists have preached about the virtues of no more nation states, just one world living in peace, with free trade and open borders and no nasty nationalism to get in the way of international unity. You know, it genuinely sounded so nice when John Lennon sang about it in Imagine. And it really sounded so scary when Adolf Hitler proclaimed that he would unite the entire world into a single Reich that would then go on to live for 1,000 years in peace. Yes, that was really his sales pitch. 1,000 years of peace. Worldwide. And most of the German people actually believed it, at least early on. The Romans used the same rationale as their empire spread across Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa 2,000 years ago. Then the Catholic Church thought that they could pull it off in the 12th century, and over the next few centuries conquered most of Europe and much of the Middle East. When they fell, Napoleon tried on that rationale, a nice French-derived word there, rationale, of a world at peace under his control. And then, of course, the British thought they could pull it off with the East India Company and the British Navy as their main agents, reaching from the Americas to Africa to Australia and New Zealand. And then, of course, the Soviets and the Americans both promised world peace, if only everybody would get on the same page with them or with us. It's still largely the American sales pitch. Although, you know, since Vietnam, it's kind of fallen flat, a lot of countries around the world. But when the Berlin Wall fell, this was the turning point. The Western world's idealists all rushed in. This was the point at which everybody who thought, hey, we can have one world living in peace. When the Berlin Wall fell, when the Soviet Union fell, this is when all the idealists And, you know, I honor and love idealists. I think of myself as one. But the mistaken idealists all rushed in to revive the German, Catholic, Roman, French, British, American idea of one world unified by open borders, free markets, and ultimately a single dominant currency. You get this? Europeans jumped in with both feet. They created the EU. They opened their borders internally. They had a shared currency, the euro. The Americans did the same thing, particularly during the Reagan and Clinton administrations, by doing away with over 200 years of protectionist trade policies, unilaterally eliminating tariffs, tearing down laws and regulations that protected labor and small business. And the wonders of that new giant transnationalists would, you know, with the idea, really, that these transnationals would bring us all international prosperity. Interestingly, the Asians mostly knew that this was starry-eyed nonsense. The Chinese moved from a failed form of communism to a government-sponsored and heavily regulated capitalism. The Taiwanese, the South Koreans, the Japanese all kept their tariffs and trade protections in place, though really often they disguised them as reverse VAT taxes or through regulatory barriers. And ironically, so did the Germans. The Germans protected their manufacturing industry by keeping national ownership, trade barriers, and laws that required big companies. Do you know this about Germany? In Germany, if a company has over 1,000 employees, and there's a lot of companies like that in the country, half your board of directors has to be made up of representatives of labor labor unions who work in your company. And this is why the companies in Germany protect their own workers by aggressively stepping in when there is a crisis with things like the Kurzarbeit. You've heard me rant about this, the short week policy. This is when the great Bush crash of 2008 hit. So the workers weren't laid off, even though the factory output plummeted for a year or so. People instead of working a 40-hour week, they were working a 30-hour week, but they were being paid for a 40-hour week because the government was making up the difference. So they still had money to spend, and the economy continued. The South and Central Americans had figured it out a decade ago. I was in Argentina in 2000 and 2001 when they told the IMF to get the hell out of their country. And the Brazilians and the Chileans were fast moving down that path around 2000. That list now of countries in the Southern Hemisphere who long ago left behind the Davos Consensus, too long to recite. Then the cracks began to show in both the United States and Europe. One of the central tenets of libertarianism is that national boundaries are unnecessary. Movement of both capital and labor should be unrestrained, these people say, because eventually the so-called free market will equalize everything and paradise will result. Didn't work out that way. America has been ravaged by multinationals, which have shut down tens of thousands of factories and moved manufacturing offshore. And when the Reagan administration stopped enforcing penalties against employers who hired non-citizens, entire industries like construction and meatpacking that were once great places to get a union job, enter the middle class, became low-wage bastions of largely Spanish-speaking labor. The early result of this libertarian experiment was obvious with the Ross-Perot campaign. Later, the Pat Buchanan Tea Partiers yelling about immigrants showed the cracks in the libertarian ideology, how it just wasn't working. And now the Occupy movement and the 99% spring and everything else coming together with labor to just say no to libertarian nonsense. Over the pond in Europe, a common currency has prevented nations from being able to control their own economic destiny, leading to disasters in Greece, Spain, Ireland, and Italy. While countries that never bought the libertarian line and instead kept their own borders regulated and their currencies under their own control, countries like Iceland, the Scandinavian countries, they told the banksters to go screw themselves. They're moving ahead with an almost arrogantly cheerful prosperity. And this week we saw it in France, arguably the biggest domino to fall. France is one of the three largest economies in Europe and led the charge for the EU and the euro. The Sarkozy government rose to power on the libertarian notion of free trade and free immigration. Ain't worked out so well. And now the people are having their say. Last weekend, they told Sarkozy, take a hike. The result, in a desperate bid to beat his only remaining rival, the socialist François Hollande, I believe is how it's pronounced, Sarkozy is now talking about limiting immigration and changing French trade policies. But the French people know who he is. He's a Reagan-Bush-Thatcher libertarian. And they know that the policies of austerity and so-called free markets that he's been pushing for years are not only failed but stupid. Even if Sarkozy wins this Sunday's election, which is unlikely, he'll never again be able to push that sort of starry-eyed libertarian pablum on the French people. The dream of one world, whether it's run by Hitler, Napoleon, King George, the Pope, the Ottomans, the Soviets, or the American-based transnational corporations, that idea of one world is dead, and appropriately so. So now, it's time for us to get busy with the work of undoing 30 years of insanity, Reaganomics, reclaiming the wealth stolen by the 1%, restoring our national independence and economy, and building a nation within a world that works because we allow for our differences and we once again respect national sovereignty. You get this? John Lennon was a great singer and a great philosopher, but on this little one thing, I think he was wrong. Your thoughts? 15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, do you see any cracks in my argument here or barriers to implementation? This is what I think can get us out of the problem. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Greg in Warren, Michigan, listening on WDTW. Hey, Greg, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I listened to your rant, and I agree with you 100%. I think it's brilliant. You correctly identified the cause of the economic problems that we're experiencing right now all over the world.
Thank you.
I only have one minor difference in opinion, and that's I don't think these people, I think there's a lot of idealists involved in this, and I think they've been kind of sucked in. But I think the real motive, the people that are really behind all this, their motivation is not idealism. They don't want to create a utopia for everybody. They want to create their own utopia, and they basically want to enslave the planet. Their motivation is not good at all. It's really bad.
I agree. And that's why I gave the examples of the Roman Empire, the Catholic Empire. The one I missed was the Ottoman Empire. Same thing. The British Empire. The attempt by Napoleon to have a French Empire. The Spanish actually tried to have empire. You know, they got South America, and on and on, and the Philippines and whatnot. And every single time somebody's really was going out to rob, rape, and pillage, you know, they really just wanted to control everything. The rationale was world peace. All right. We're all together. World peace. We'll all, you know, everything will be wonderful.
That's a lie.
Yeah. And that, you know, and as I pointed out, that was Hitler's thing. He's, you know, we're going to have 1,000 years of peace, the Third Reich. And people bought into it. Greg, thanks a lot for the call. And thanks for listening to WDTW. I appreciate it. Let's see here. Helena in Chicago?
Yep.
Hey, what's up?
Helena from Chicago. Hi. Yeah, I don't agree with you about John Lennon. I think where he came from was a real looking at humanity, looking at, you know, the family of man. We're all together on this little globe. And, you know, the spirit was there. And I don't think, for me, that's where I operate from. You know,
I agree with the spirit.
The banksters and the robbers and the thieves and the cutthroats, which happen to be all legitimate, unfortunately, right now. You know, they go to the best of universities and learn how to steal.
Yeah.
You know, if we could play nice like children did, we might stand a chance to save this planet and our culture, which I think is in terrible disarray.
We may well. Here's where I'm with John Lennon and where I'm not with John Lennon in his suggestion. You know, imagine there's no countries, right? No borders to defend and all that kind of thing, and no need for wars, et cetera, et cetera. The question is, if you're going to have one world, if you're going to have no nations, and you're going to have one world, there's two issues. This is the first. There's going to have to be some agency that just administers basic functions. And, yeah, I mean, in other words, somebody has to be in charge. So the question is, who do you want that to be? Do you want it to be the British East India Company? Do you want it to be the transnational corporations? Do you want it to be the government of France? Do you want it to be the technocrats in Brussels? Do you want it to, you know, and that's the problem. And the second point is that when you look at biological systems, if you look at a forest isn't nothing but pine trees. You know, it's a thousand different kinds of plants and animals all interacting with each other. Lots and lots of diversity. And similar, I think it's the same thing with human culture, that the more diversity we have, you know, we're losing about a language, a human language, every couple days on this planet largely because of evangelists going into tribal areas. And that's a loss of culture. So that's why I would push back on the one world. Am I making sense, Helena?
Yeah, you're making sense, but the thing is, if there was representatives from each and every with equal voting rights, not the big guys get it because we can have the nuclear arms, but they can't, nonsense.
Right.
You know, we could look at the whole structure as being of not equality as far as numbers, but an equal representation of each and every one of us.
Well, with regard,
which is including all the diversity.
Sure, and with regard to international conflict, that's what we have with the United Nations, and I'm a big fan of the United Nations because they don't try to be a one world government. The one area where countries have to be accountable to the United Nations, everything else is voluntary, but the one area where countries have to be accountable to the United Nations is if they're going to commit war, if they're going to attack another country. And then, you know, rules kick into place and there are penalties for the leaders and all those kind of things. And I actually think that that's a good thing. Helena, thank you for the call and thank you for your thoughtful commentary on this. Ed in Seattle. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Oh, hi, Tom. I just had a question about what you were talking about last hour about Herbert Hoover, how he, you know, tried austerity and it didn't work.
Well, he did and he didn't. I mean, for a while he tried doing nothing. For a while he tried cutting back. For a while he actually created one of the agencies. It wasn't the Resolution Trust, but it was one of the three-letter ones that starts with an R that Franklin Roosevelt made successful. And you know, but it was too little, too late, is the problem that Hoover had.
Yes, but what I'm getting at is that, you know, this is always seems to be what they try first.
Yeah.
And they have to know that it doesn't work, so there has to be something going on that doesn't meet the eye. More
yeah,
than
it's squeeze.
So what is it there that's really going on?
They're trying to squeeze the last little bit out of us, out of the middle class, out of working people, out of you know, this is the 1% taking it down to the point where you're wearing a barrel and then saying, now I want the barrel. And Ed, in my opinion, that's what's going on. Thanks a lot for the call. That's my take on it. Scott in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, Scott, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up?
Hey, Tim. I want to disagree. I think it's really the neocons that are with their Iran.
No, the neocons are nationalists.
Philosophy.
The neocons are nationalists. They wanted America to end up ruling everything, right? Or at least ruling the Middle East.
I think they're using libertarian philosophy. I think they saw that as an opportunity and a front to get what they want done, and they're really the ones behind this. And you were talking about the different factions who want to rule the world. I think you missed one with the banksters who are basically doing an experiment in Greece. Of taking their sovereignty and putting in somebody that's not even voted in and that's part of the bank system.
Yeah, well, and they did the same thing with Italy, too. You've got two countries now that have had sovereignly, you know, the people have elected leaders, and those leaders have been displaced and replaced by banksters, literally by banksters, by unelected banksters to run the countries. And, I mean, this is how bizarre it's getting. Pay attention. Real, genuine, small-d democracy is at risk.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. How do we bring about one world at peace? I have an idea.
But I said no.
Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And how do we create one world at peace? As I said, I personally believe that we do it with diversity, with nationalism is a nasty word, but or has been interpreted by many. But that's anyhow. Andy in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Hal. Andy, welcome to the program. What's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me. I've been listening for years, and I have never called, so it's a pleasure to speak with you. Really wish I had $2,000 and I could hang out with you. I really like your question about what it takes to have a one world at peace, and your question about you know, unity and no borders and no nations.
Mm-hmm.
And what it brings up to me, I'm a student here in Albuquerque, community and regional planning or city planning, and I'm interested in urban design. And it brings up something to me that I believe is that, well, scale matters a great deal to our lives, to our identity, and
sure.
And the kind of spaces that we design, you know, they pertain to a certain kind of life activity. And I think that without a local connection or without an identity of something smaller, we can't really build into something bigger. And I do believe very much in world peace and world unity, but it's more really a world harmony. And
that's a good way of putting it, you know. That we all get it, that we're all people here, and so we're going to do things about, like, for example, global warming or, you know, nuclear pollution of our oceans. We'll do that collaboratively, but we still retain our separate identities as peoples or as nations or even as states and counties and cities and things like that. These semi-permeable membranes that we have always created as societies. And we do it to keep the predators out. We do it to keep, to work for our own interest. Andy, thank you very much for the call. Very well said. Miles in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Miles, what's up?
Hi, Tom. What I was going to say is that what you described as party lines, it isn't libertarianism. It's globalism. It's this new world order thought that there's going to be this, central government. And what has happened in the mix of everything that our politicians and all politicians in general, they left out the word sovereignty. They don't respect our country or their country first.
Yeah, although I would say it is libertarianism, because if you talk to libertarians, they will tell you one of the central tenets of libertarianism is that there should not, that all national boundaries should be totally porous with regard to both labor and capital.
Well, let's just pick one that's kind of a libertarian in Congress. Ron Paul, he's against NAFTA, GATT, everything that Democrats supported. Remember, we had Clinton supporting GATT and NAFTA. Bush.
He was against those policies because they further regulated trade. He thought there should be no regulations whatsoever on trade.
That limitation was on American sovereignty. But guess what? Clinton, Bush, and then Obama.
No, you are mischaracterizing Ron Paul's position. I'm telling you, Ron Paul was opposed to GATT, NAFTA, the WTO, those kinds of programs, because he saw those. He did say these were infringements of our national sovereignty, but he also thinks and has said many times that he thinks that there should be absolute freedom of passage across our borders, both to people and to capital, which means that he wanted to go a whole lot farther than Clinton and Bush and all those guys did.
Well, if I recall, he's the one that's been bringing up the whole, the conspiracy theorists of the North American Union in the context of that. But also, what's the problem I see is, where is the outrage from the Democrats and the Republicans? Where is this push for, and I say this, nationalism? I mean, it's a national unity, not some racial movement, for national economies. Like you said, Germany's good, has a great national economy. There's no push from the Democrats or Republicans to support those type of incentives, perhaps.
Well, and that's my point, is that we need to have a national manufacturing policy, a national trade policy, a national economic policy. Miles, thank you for the call. I think it's pretty straightforward stuff. We'll see where it goes. Gus in New York City. Hey, Gus, what's up? No Gus. Okay, Scott in Sand Creek, Michigan. Hey, Scott, what's up?
How are you doing today?
Great. Thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's on your mind?
Well, the whole idea behind, world peace and living under one thing, regardless of what you construct, the fact of the matter is that human nature can never really truly ever allow it to happen. We live in a fallen world, and human nature is one of evil, and there's greed.
I disagree.
It doesn't matter.
I disagree.
Well, it doesn't matter what kind of government or what kind of thing you construct, it literally is impossible for everyone to agree and share and
around. I agree with that, but I don't think that that's because our nature is essentially sinful. Now, I agree with that, but I don't think that that's because our nature is essentially sinful, or because man fell, or because Eve ate an apple and therefore we should, repress women, or what, all these other various stories. If our nature was evil, we would not have evolved as a species this far. Our nature is to be cooperative. The evil is the aberration among us. And you know, a very thoughtful guy on this is, and in fact, you go back and read Ishmael and My Ishmael by Daniel, what's his last name? In any case, and it's just his suggestion was that this all began with the agricultural revolution, with the idea that we can lock up food. And as soon as you could lock up something, as soon as you could keep people away from something that was essential for life, then you had power over them, and then the sociopaths came out. And I think that there's something to that. Scott, Daniel Quinn is his name. And thank you very much for the call. Christy in Fort Collins, Colorado, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Christine, excuse me. What's up?
Yes, Christine. Thanks, Tom. Before I get to my question, I just wanted to... I couldn't help but notice when you were talking about the goddess Columbia, mm-hmm. when nothing could rise up above her in the city.
Yes.
Until what point in time was that?
You know, I'd have to go back and look. It's been a while since I've read up on the Washington Monument.
Okay, I guess what I'm what
but
my,
it's a male monument.
I was about to say. So finally, the big phallic erect symbol,
yeah.
is the thing that's allowed to, you know, go up and surpass the female. So I just thought it was just a funny take in
yep.
the war on women.
I don't disagree. I think it was the late 19th century, like the 1880s or thereabouts. But I'd have to look it up.
My question for you, when you were talking about what's going on in Europe,
mm-hmm.
and how their banking system collapsed, you associated the repeal, the deregulation that was the result of repealing Glass-Steagall.
Yes.
How can you explain in kind of like an Econ 101 way how the repeal of Glass-Steagall and the laws that the deregulation that took place here in the United States,
right.
how that ended up affecting
Europe. Sure.
Now, Matt Taibbi has talked about these things, but I'm just one of those people who can't read long articles online, so I was hoping you could...
Let me give you the Cliff Notes version, or at least my understanding of the Cliff Notes version.
That's what I'd like, yes.
This wasn't just one single incident. What it was really was a zeitgeist, a spirit of the times, a gestalt, a belief system that Margaret Thatcher brought to all of us in the late 70s, and that Jimmy Carter even bought into. You know, in the last 2 years of his presidency, he deregulated the trucking industry, and he deregulated the travel industry, and it began the process of even some deregulation, some small deregulation of the banks. And while we officially broke Glass-Steagall basically said, it was passed in 1935, and what it said was that if you're the kind of bank that has checking accounts and savings accounts, and that which are called commercial banks, then you can't use your depositors' money to gamble. You can't be involved in
right.
the stock market.
I understand.
On the other hand, if you're like Goldman Sachs and you don't take deposits, instead you take investments, you can gamble all day long and make or lose money for your customers, and everybody understands what they're getting. Most countries of the world after the Great Depression figured out that if you don't split financial institutions into these two kinds, these two separate categories, that you're going to have another crash like we had in the 20s and 30s. And so, you know, most countries had the equivalent of Glass-Steagall. As this deregulation fad started taking over Europe, taking over North America, taking over South America, for that matter, you had down in Chile when Augusto Pinochet took over Chile, the military dictator, and you had Milton Friedman advising him on how to privatize Social Security and hand it over to the banksters, which he did. So what happened was in many of these countries, and particularly the United States and the UK, the ability of commercial banks and investment banks to merge, whether it's a literal merger or whether it's a collaborative behavior merger, became as it was here in the United States. You know, we just totally tore down the barrier with Phil Graham, with the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act in either 99 or 2000. And so it only took a couple of very, very large institutions to fail here in the United States, mostly, and a couple on the edge, teetering on the edge in the UK and in Germany. And in Germany, they actually, to the best of my knowledge, had not broken that wall of separation within Germany. But Deutsche Bank was operating in the United States doing both. They couldn't do that in Germany. And so what happened was we collapsed the world economy. And then you've got this, and then this.
Okay, that's the part I'm not understanding. How did we?
We let our banksters create a form of so-called wealth that didn't exist. They took bets on mortgages and literally sold $800 trillion worth of bets on about $5 or $10 trillion worth of mortgages. And that was phony baloney, right? They were creating money out of nowhere, and they sold that to, like, the Icelandic people, who have since said, no, we're not going to pay you back. You know, we bought a pig in a poke. They sold that to the Spaniards. They sold it to the Greeks. They sold it all over the world. And so
that's where the link is.
That's the huge link. And Matt Taibbi does a great job of writing about that. Christine, thank you very much for the call. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. How do we create a world that works? We'll continue with this conversation and check in with the Talk Radio News Service as we continue through the next hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Ellen Ratner in the studio with us. Brought to you, Talk Radio News, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, which is Ellen's effort to bring some money and to save some lives in South Sudan, which was on the front page of the Washington Post today. I don't know if you saw that, about this. It starts out with the story of this woman in South Sudan who her village got bombed last week, and she said, if only we didn't have oil, they wouldn't be coming to kill us.
That's true, right. In that part, in our part, people, they already took them as war booty, but we don't have oil, although our governor said that when he dug for water, he found oil. So, I know. I don't even want to say where we're from. But anyway.
Yeah. And your goats for the old goat, you've got this.
We have these women who make these hearts. They've all seen somebody killed in front of them. They're in our post-traumatic stress group. And we're selling them for Mother's Day, so you can go to goatsfortheoldgoat.com, and we can get it for you in time for Mother's Day.
That is so cool. And it's a little
Swarovski crystal. Yes.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. It's beautiful.
Beautiful hearts.
Yeah. Okay.
Goatsfortheoldgoat.com.
Okay.
All right. So,
old goat, what's up?
Old goat, what's up? Well, I think we should talk about the oldest goat of all, and that's Newt Gingrich.
Oh, yes. He olds us and out goats both of us. Yes.
That's right. Well, he did not take any questions at his presser today. Why am I not surprised?
Yeah.
His wife was there, Callista. Mm-hmm. His daughter, his grandchildren, I guess he had two of them there, about 8 and 12, said our reporter. Mm-hmm. Only about 50 reporters showed up, despite the fact there is the slowest news day in Washington. The president is just at a fundraisers after having gotten back from Afghanistan. Congress is out of session. I mean, it is slow, and only 50 reporters showed up. So what does that tell you? He said he is going to be a private active citizen. He's going to discuss space and brain research, which actually I'd love to talk to him about brain research, because that's something I'm very interested in. You know,
and how did his brain get that strange?
there's a very famous football player that they think committed suicide, and I said he had to have a traumatic brain injury, and apparently he has.
Yeah.
Just a few minutes ago. But I don't even know his name. Anyway, he did not formally endorse Mitt Romney. He said no matter what, a candidate will be more conservative than Obama. He said, we haven't had since Carter and Reagan, there hasn't been such a dramatic contrast. And, of course, he just made sure with that Obama's going to get his base out.
Yeah.
And he said that Obama was to the left of President Carter.
Well, that's interesting. I don't know if it's true or not. I would say probably not. But the one piece of interesting gossip that I've heard that I'd like to reality check with you, Ellen Ratner,
gossip.
Is that Newt's campaign is $4.3 million in debt.
That's right.
And that Mitt Romney's campaign has said that basically if Newt will endorse him, then the RNC and the Romney campaign will pay off Newt's debt.
Well, essentially,
so
the
price.
Rumor has it that he will endorse Romney in a couple, 2 to 3 weeks.
Once he gets his bucks?
Once he either gets his bucks or he takes Callista on another one of those. Remember, he took on a 2-week Mediterranean cruise?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so yeah. I think that's what's going to happen.
But it's basically a payoff,
right.
Is my understanding, that the Romney campaign
is. Oh, yes,
is gonna,
just like they've done for everybody else.
Oh, really?
They haven't done it for Santorum, but they did it for Governor... Oh, gosh.
Rick Perry?
The Minnesota.
Oh, yeah, Tim Pawlenty.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, now a little bit more campaign news. A group called Restore Our Future, they're a right-wing group. They are doing Colorado, Florida, Iowa, Michigan, Nevada, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Ohio, Virginia, the purple states pretty much. Right. And they're putting out a $4.3 million ad buy. Now, remember, this is a super PAC, so it doesn't have to go through the campaign, whatever. And what is their ad going to be doing? It is called Saved, and it's Governor Romney's efforts to find his former business partner's 14-year-old daughter after she went missing in New York City. So, in other words, they're building them up to this nice guy that you want to have as your neighbor and that you want to have in your living room for the next 4 years.
Because he did something nice once.
Right.
Gee. Well... Pardon my cynicism. I'm guessing his neighbor wasn't laid off by one of the companies that Bain Capital bought up and squeezed.
No, it was his partner in Bain, I think, or something.
Oh,
else.
I see. So
it was
one of his daughter. One of his fellow. Yeah, okay.
Right, exactly.
I mean, nobody wants anybody's daughter to be kidnapped, God forbid. But
now, I don't often bring up a lot of things written by other journalists, but today, actually, there was an interesting piece by Andrew Sullivan in The Dish, and basically he's talking about Grinnell, and he said, yes, Grinnell was prepared to work for an administration. This is the guy Romney got.
Oh, this is the openly gay foreign policy advisor that the Romney administration 2 weeks ago said, look at this, we're hiring an openly gay policy
advisor.
And then
they got a lot of grief.
Well, not only did they get a lot of grief, but they basically told the guy, don't go out in front of any cameras.
Well, my favorite line here is, yes, Grinnell was prepared to work for an administration opposed to marriage equality, even when he supported it passionately, like Ahem Dick Cheney.
Oh, that's interesting.
Very interesting. But basically he said... what was his reward for loyalty? Vilification.
Yeah, and he was.
Now, a couple other interesting things. One is South Sudan. The UN passed a resolution threatening Sudan sanctions, and they passed against South Sudan and South Sudan if they don't end their fighting and resume negotiations.
Wait a minute. Are they asking South Sudan to, like, unilaterally...
Well, they want to get them back to the negotiating table.
Is South Sudan being purely defensive, or are they also being offensive in this?
They're being a bit offensive.
In this disputed area where there's oil.
Well, but if you ask the Dinka folks that I deal with, as you know, every day, they'll say, yes, this was an oil region. Yes, this supposedly went to Sudan, but it was, before the war, a Dinka region that Sudan then claimed and then took as part of the peace settlement.
So now we've got tribal areas.
So it's basically, the issue is that it's tribal. And I've talked, between Boston and here, I probably talked to 10 Dinka folks a week.
Yeah.
And that's what they're all saying. Hey, it's our land, really.
Right. It's remarkable. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service. And if you want to learn more about it, go to goatsfortheoldgoat.com.
Get a heart for Mother's Day.
There you go. You can get a heart for Mother's Day. Thank you, Ellen. Great talking with you. We'll be back. I want to continue this conversation about how can we make a world that works in peace? And what would be the pieces to it? Where does nationalism fit into it? And how does America bring it about, too?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. So here's the question that I want to present. We've tried this experiment, right? The it was a fundamentally libertarian idea that the world works best if individual governments don't try to do things their way, but instead that economies and countries and people all bow to the god of the great free market, the so-called free market. That, in fact, here's the way that it was described by Milton Friedman. And it still is today. I mean, you'll hear Rand Paul talking about like this. Every second of the day, there are hundreds of millions of individual economic decisions being made in the marketplace. How could any government employee,
government bureaucrat,
or elected official, even, sitting, no matter how wise he or she may be, or how educated, how could they possibly make a decision that would be as smart as the collective wisdom of millions of people making millions of economic decisions a second? Sounds good, doesn't it? The problem is that all of those economic decisions, it confuses governance and commerce. Governance is when we the people decide to protect our basic needs for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The basic things that we need to have as a society. Now, we're not going to protect our right to manufacture a car or our right to manufacture blue jeans. We are going to, however, protect the rights of the workers who are making them. And we're going to protect people from predators who might make them in ways that would harm them. So we're going to say, you can't sell a car that blows up. Or you can't sell a toy that will poison a child. But in any case, the basic rights, we're going to protect those. And different governments do this to different extents and in different ways, but they do it. I mean, it's one of the reasons why governments, among men where did my Constitution go? I was going to read to you from the Declaration of Independence, but in our move, I have misplaced it. Governments were created, to do these things, right, to bring this about. So commerce is a completely different, commerce, okay, fine, but even commerce should be subordinate to the needs of we the people. But anyhow, this libertarian idea came along that, let's let the marketplace decide. Let's let the marketplace decide everything. Let's let it decide whether or not we're going to have immigration, and if so, how much. In fact, let's not even have that concept. Let's just say that all borders are porous. People can live anywhere they want in the world. And let's say that all money is fungible. All money is poor. All borders are porous to money, too. And capital can go anywhere it wants. And so factories can be set up, however and wherever. And nice idea. Doesn't work. We've been trying this now for 30 years. The fall of the Berlin Wall was a big trigger to really put this on steroids. Although that happened a year after Reagan left office. Keep in mind, that happened in the George Herbert Walker Bush administration. But remember what he said afterwards? Old George H.W., George, Grandpa George, remember what he said? He said, he started talking about 1,000 points of light and a new world order. A new world order. Right. Where everything is run by who? The billionaires. The big transnational corporations. I mean, that's, frankly, I believe the subtext to it. So my suggestion is that when it comes to issues of conflict, of war and peace, of countries taking on each other, that we do need a governing body. We do need a collective agency for the world. It was the League of Nations for a while. Now it's the United Nations. And I think that it should have even perhaps a little more enforcement power than it has. Because, for example, what we're seeing right now between North and South Sudan, or Sudan and South Sudan. On the other hand, individual nations should be able to say, our people, the majority of our people want to live this way. And they should be set up so that that actually happens. I find it amazing that in the United States of America, the majority of people, well over 60, 70, 80%, depending on the studies you're looking at or the surveys you're looking at, the majority of the people think that college education should be free for young people. The majority of the people in America think that Medicare and Social Security should be solid and stable. You should be able to retire without fear. The majority of Americans think that health care should be essentially free. And when you consider how much money we spend for these things in the private marketplace, If we were running that money through government instead of the private marketplace, it would actually be more efficient and we would spend less and we get more services like they do in other countries. So why is it if the majority of Americans want these things, we don't have them? Well, because in particular over the last 30 years, we've had this idea of, oh, well, let's just let the marketplace make the decisions. In other words, let the billionaires make the decisions. And then the Supreme Court got out ahead of this saying, well, you know, corporations are people, money is speech, and on it goes. So my point is that we have had no shortage over the millennia of groups who came along and said, we'll create a world in peace. Just give it to us. Right? Like that Roosevelt, that old Roosevelt quote about, you know, the Republicans, you know, they'll take care of Social Security, right? I don't know if you could easily grab that, Jacob. It's just so classic because the perfect analogy to this is, now just, you know, keep in mind, Hitler said, we'll give you world peace. Just give the world to us. Napoleon, we'll give you peace, just give the world to us. The Soviets, we'll give you peace, just give the world to us. The Americans, we'll give you peace, just give the world to us. And here's the smaller version of it. This is Franklin Roosevelt back in 1935.
Let me warn you and let me warn the nation against the smooth evasion that says, of course we believe these things. We believe in Social Security. We believe in work for the unemployed. We believe in saving homes. Cross our hearts and hope to die. We believe in all these things. But we do not like the way the present administration is doing them. Just turn them over to us. We will do all of them. We will do more of them. We will do them better. And most important of all, the doing of them will not cost anybody anything.
Right. And that's the pitch for world peace, is that it'll be automatic. This is what's so seductive about the libertarian philosophy, is that it's automatic. It's the way of nature. It's actually not the way of nature. The way of nature is small d democratic and is filled with diversity. But, you know, the libertarians are like, well, just kind of turn everything over to the so-called free market. And automatically it'll stabilize itself. And government shouldn't do things like protecting their people, particularly during times of Great Depression. If they do that, they go into debt. And if they go into debt, then that might hurt the banksters, and we can't have that. And so, Greece, you're going to have to lay off a bunch of your employees. Get it? We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, if you think I'm right or wrong, and we've got a whole bunch of you who do, we'll pick up this conversation just on the other side of this break.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm a liberal smarty. And I know just what they're trying to do. Telling those old white folks, vote Republican Party. Or the gay commies will come for you. I see O'Reilly on the TV and he's starting to rant. Must be Fox News. Oh yeah, they're selling propaganda and pretending it's fact. Must be Fox News with those right-wing
views. I call it Fox, so-called news. Talk about fact. Tom Hartman here with you, exposing the con in conservative. And today it's the something in libertarian. The lib in libertarian? I don't think so. Josie in Brooklyn, New York. Thanks for listening to WWRL. What's on your mind, Josie?
Totally interesting conversation. I listen to you often and WWRL a lot. And on many topics, I live in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. and our commons is being reduced by way of the fire department, our bravest. Mm-hmm. has very drastic for several years budget cuts
mm-hmm.
as if the bravest don't save lives and
right.
each other.
And as if we don't need them.
As if they are like, it's not the same waiting 3 minutes for a library book as when your house is burning. first of all. So, and several of the cuts are scheduled repeatedly to be in Brooklyn in very poor neighborhoods. And on Saturday, I will have an event listed at Brooklyn Fire Ant. It's the 9th annual event.
Oh, that's great. Is there a website for it?
What?
Is there a website for it?
Yeah, Brooklyn Fire Ant.
Brooklyn Fire Ant.
It's a blog. It'll show
okay,
up. Brooklyn
great.
Fire Ant.
Okay, great.
And my other question to you is related to the hypothetical, air quotes, family values that were never defined to me, to my understanding, and the bishops, the Georgetown Bishops Conference letter to responding to the Ryan budget. I think it's beyond just beyond comprehending the ripples that's going to create.
Yeah, I'm absolutely with you, Josie. Thank you for mentioning that. And this is, you know, Paul Ryan waves around his Catholicism, as does John Boehner, and yet they're promoting a budget that the Catholic bishops say is more consistent with the philosophy of atheist Ayn Rand and than it is with the Catholic teachings. Marius in Los Angeles. Hey, Marius, what's up?
Hey, Tom, big fan, first-time caller.
Thank you.
I was watching Tom Coburn on Charlie Rose last night.
Hmm.
And one thing that he said, I guess he wrote a new book, and he said in 1920, 1921, they let the market fix itself, and it healed itself in a year and a half. And, yeah, there was negative 24% loss of GDP, but because they let the market heal itself, it did it in a year and a half. Whereas when FDR took over, it took him until World War II, and even then, it was the war that fixed it, not him. And I know you're a big history buff, and I know he's lying, so just wanted you to straighten him out.
Yeah, it's a good example of figures don't lie, but liars can figure. There was a stock market crash around 1920, 21, and you know, Hoover came into office in 1921, dropped the top tax rate down to 25%, and basically kicked off an enormous bubble. And that bubble economy that ran for 9 years and then popped, it ran the stock market up radically. And the market didn't heal itself. What the market did is it went into a cycle of bubbles like we've seen ever since the Reagan tax cuts. And, you know, bubble burst, bubble burst, bubble burst. And that was a relatively small bubble compared to the one that blew up in 1929 as a result of Hoover's policies of not intervening in the marketplace. I'm not suggesting that intervening in the marketplace in general, you know, in stock markets and things, is something that government should be doing. But regulating them so that they can't be manipulated against us is something that I think is really important. And then to Coburn's point that it was World War II that got us out of the Great Depression, he's actually right to a large extent. And here's why it's important that you understand that he's right and he's lying at the same time. What World War II did was basically tripled federal spending, okay, in the United States.
Yeah.
And by tripling federal spending in the United States, we suddenly went from a 20, you know, I think Roosevelt had gotten us down to around 12% unemployment, but 11, 12%, something like that, you know, from the high of 35. We went from 12% to zero, right? There was no unemployment because we tripled federal spending. Now, we spent it on a war, but we tripled federal spending. And what that says is that if in 1933, when Roosevelt came into office, instead of throwing whatever he threw at, you know, he ultimately hired the federal government ultimately hired, I believe it was 10.7 million Americans over the next 8 or 9 years. If Roosevelt, instead of spending whatever that cost, and let's just say for fun, you know, that it was $1 trillion in today's dollars. I genuinely don't know how much it was, but whatever it was, if he had simply spent three times as much in 1933, in other words, if he had gone to the levels of spending that we had to use to get to win World War II, if he had done that in 1933, the Great Depression would have been over in a year. And so it's the exact opposite of what Coburn is saying. Coburn is saying that, well, you know, government spending didn't get us out of the Great Depression from 1933 to 1942, 41. Well, actually, it did to a large extent. It just didn't do it fast enough. And then he says, but the war got us out. Well, wars don't, like, magically fix things. Wars blow up things and kill people. It was the manufacturing for the war, and that was paid for by massive government borrowing that got us out of the Great Depression, ultimately. That got us to a zero unemployment or very, very low unemployment economy. And so the lesson of this is that if Obama wants to get us out of this mess, he should have early on done three times, as Paul Krugman was saying, the Bush administration kicked a $2.7 trillion hole in the side of our economy, and we patched it with an $800 billion patch. And we still should be throwing another $2 trillion at that. And frankly, I think we might next year. So that's the story, Marius. Thanks a lot for calling.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Isn't this stuff fascinating? I am absolutely fascinated by how governments work and how we can put together countries in ways that work with each other. Yep, it's the good, the bad, and the very, very flatulopetitiously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good, Aphrodite Boukides. Boukides is the director of the Reinventing Greece Media Project, an organization that seeks to engage Greek-American college students to come up with solutions to help the nation rebuild. She told the SE Times, many people want to read positive news, and when they read about times of crisis or institutions that don't work, they ask, what can I do about this? Boukides hopes that the project will answer these questions and unite the entire Greek community so that the country can recover from its economic collapse. No doubt Greece is in turmoil, and it's these kinds of grassroots efforts that are going to be needed to promote change and rebuild the nation. The bad. The CFO of Wells Fargo, Tim Sloan, chief financial officer. Last week, Anna Cassis Wilson, a California homeowner who has cerebral palsy, went to Sloan's house and waited on his porch so she could personally give him a payment on her foreclosed house. Wilson fell behind on her mortgage payments due to hospital stays, and while she can now afford to make the payments again, Wells Fargo won't modify her loan and won't stop the foreclosure procedure. Wilson thought going to Sloan in person would help, but instead Sloan had her arrested. Mr. Sloan's actions are a great example of the lack of empathy big banks have for the customers whose lives they are ruining. And the very, very ugly, Pastor Sean Harris. During a sermon in Fayetteville, North Carolina on Sunday, so-called Pastor Harris talked about his support for the state's Amendment 1, which would legally define marriage as between one man and one woman and outlaw civil unions and domestic partnerships. In the sermon, Harris also suggested that parents attack their children if they are displaying behaviors outside of typical gender norms. His ignorance and tolerance aside, so-called Pastor Harris is encouraging and condoning child abuse, and that is very, very ugly. Okay, I mentioned George Washington. One of the folks in the scorched earth in the chat room says, the problem, Tom, I was talking about spending and stimulus and, you know, how individual nations can build their economies. And what you have to have is that semi-permeable membrane of a trade policy. Every nation needs this. This is not just how do we make America work. It's every nation needs to be doing this. But on the other hand, we shouldn't be presuming to tell every nation how to do it. They have to figure it out themselves or work it out themselves or do it their own way. But anyhow, of course, it says in the chat room, the problem, Tom, is that massive spending this time in the United States will just go to create a market for foreign manufactured items. It's not going to create jobs in the States as long as we continue to allow unrestricted imports. And you're absolutely right. And that's why I wanted to share with you, this is apropos of both the issues we're talking about. This is from my book, Rebooting the American Dream. It's the first three paragraphs of the first chapter of the book. First, it starts with a letter from Thomas Jefferson to William Charles Jarvis, September 18th, 1820. He says, I know of no safe depository of the ultimate powers of society, but the people themselves. And if we think them not enlightened enough to exercise their control with a wholesome discretion, the remedy is not to take it from them, but to inform their discretion by education. This is the true corrective of abuses of constitutional power. You get it? Thomas Jefferson says, give the people the power and give them free education. Okay, and here's the story. On April 14th, 1789, George Washington was out walking through the fields at Mount Vernon, his home in Virginia, when Charles Thompson, the Secretary of the Continental Congress, rode up on horseback. Thompson had a letter for Washington from the President pro tem of the new constitutionally created United States Senate, telling Washington that he had just been elected president and the inauguration was set for April 30th in the nation's capital, New York City. Now, keep in mind, this was April 14th, 1789. This created two problems for George Washington. The first was saying goodbye to his 82-year-old mother, which the 57-year-old George Washington did that night. She gave him her blessing and told him it was the last time he would see her alive, as she was gravely ill, and indeed, she died before he returned from New York. Second problem was finding a suit of clothes made in America. For that, he sent a courier to his old friend and federal general from the American Revolutionary War, Henry Knox. Washington couldn't find a suit made in America because in the years prior to the American Revolution, the British East India Company controlled the manufacture and transport of all this stuff. So, and then I go into a fairly long rant about that. And then, fortunately for George Washington, an American clothing company had been established on April 28, 1873 in Hartford, Connecticut, by a man named Daniel Hinsdale. And it produced high-quality woolen and cotton clothing, as well as things made from imported silk. So he sent Henry Knox to Mr. Hinsdale and said, would you please give me a suit? And George Washington wore that suit when he was sworn in, and thus began the practice of buying made-in-America things. It's pretty cool. It's pretty important stuff, actually. Moana in Silverton, Oregon?
It's Mona.
Mona. Okay, Mona.
Yeah, hi.
What's up?
Hi, Tom. You're my intellectual hero, first of all.
Well, thank you.
I have to tell you this. I have a couple of things I wanted to bring up. When you mention ways that we could have world peace, I think there's like three principles, and one would be education, then health care and the general welfare of people, and good stewardship of our environment.
I would add to that list probably the thing that I think would have the greatest impact over the short term, and that's the empowerment of women in those countries where they're not empowered.
Correct. And now the other thing I wanted to bring up, when you were mentioning Reagan, and I love it when you go on little rants about Reagan, I think his complicity in destroying the middle class, one of the instruments he used, I believe, was granting amnesty to immigrants in 1987, or right around there. And I think he did it for diabolical reasons. I don't think he did it as an altruistic measure. I think he did it to create a cheap labor force that then went into all of these, like the meat packing, agricultural, restaurants.
Well, it wasn't, Mona, so much that the amnesty did that. I mean, because the amnesty, gave amnesty to people who were already here. And many of them were working good jobs, or those who weren't. But, you know, at the time that he gave the amnesty, those were still industries that were largely good union jobs. What happened, though, along with that amnesty, was he stopped enforcing the laws against employers.
Correct.
In the previous administrations, I mean, all the way back to the Eisenhower administration, Richard Nixon, when he was vice president, I mean, they if employers were hiring people who were not U.S. citizens, they went to jail, or they got big fines and penalties, or their companies got shut down, and Reagan stopped the enforcement of that. And what that did is that said to employers, hey, we can start hiring people who aren't citizens. And that's why I keep saying, and Mona, thank you very much for calling and making this point. This is an important point. It's why I say we don't have an illegal immigrant problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem. Jeff in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, we are seeing what causes wars and causes society's collapse. It's usually over energy, out-of-control growth.
You're absolutely right.
And the imbalance of the finances.
Yeah.
And I think one thing we have to look at – go ahead.
Well, I was going to say in my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, I laid this out about the Roman Empire – when they had completely denuded Italy, they didn't leave Italy. They didn't invade the Northern Europe until they had completely denuded Italy. They cut down all the trees, And one of the major things that they were cutting these trees down for was to build to put fires in the kilns that were smelting metals. And,
and concrete too.
Yeah, and they're silver coins. What happened was they had this currency crisis because it suddenly they didn't have trees. They had to import trees, you know, to make their silver coins, and so it cost them more than the coin's value. And so that's when they started invading other countries to get their wood, which was their energy source back then. You're absolutely right. And it was a combination of an energy crisis and a currency crisis.
And Athens was a similar thing. They built too many ships, and they destroyed the forests around there. And everybody,
yep.
Anyway, outstripping resources. The other thing is we have to start thinking, seeing that we need a society of equanimity, not constant growth. And as far as finances, we have to get rid of business models such as health insurance we have now, where the business succeeds by denying services. We have to get rid of businesses that their success is based on something negative.
Yeah, excellent point, Jeff. Excellent point. Thank you very much. Very, very well said. Robert in New York City. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Yeah, I've got to apologize for that thing. I'm trying to hook Lenny Moore and Rosie Gray and Paterno up with you because he went too fast for it to happen. But the other thing is that I'm an Onondaga, and I have so much history that was given to me that's not in books about the early situation, especially that Albany Plan of Union.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing is, I don't know if you've ever read Richard Poe on how the ancient African civilized Europe and about the wolves that would come into the towns and ravage people.
No, I've not.
No,
I am familiar with the Onondaga and the Plan of Union, but only peripherally. I mean, I've read about them, but I've not read them.
No, well, I had people from my family live there, and you know, they passed on oral traditions. And one of the oral traditions was it's the same thing like the European thing. They didn't know how many people were Iroquois, you know, throughout the nation, and they were afraid of being attacked by the Iroquois nation because of the strength of the Iroquois nation.
Robert, would you hold that thought right there? Do you mind? And I'd like to pick it up on the other side of the break. Oh, hold on. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. We'll pick up with Robert's story about the Iroquois Confederacy and more of your calls right after this.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
My friend Richard Green was in town a couple of days ago, and he texted me from the U.S. Capitol building. And I had told him, you know, Columbia is up on top of the Capitol. She was called Freedom. She's been called Liberty. I think her official name on top of the Capitol is Freedom. And, in fact, I have to dig this text out for you and share it with you. And, but it's apropos of what's going on here. Richard Green, here it is. And he says, Celeste and I are walking around the Capitol building and asked three guards the name of the statue. Not one knew it was Columbia. Amazing. So, pardon the digression there, but before I bring Robert back on, I wanted to just tell you about Leonard Schlain wrote this book called The Alphabet Versus the Goddess. And it really was based on books written prior by Robert Logan's Oralcy Versus Literacy and another book by Ong that had a very similar title. I forget the exact title, but the essence of these books was that cultures that had oral traditions actually have better memories than cultures that have written traditions. Because when we write things down, we forget them. We put them in books and stick them in libraries. Whereas cultures that didn't write things down but had oral traditions have intact memories that can last millennia. They found among the Abenaki Native Americans in Vermont, for example, that they had memories of when the giant ice sheets receded that were more accurate than the estimates and guesses that had been made by geologists when they actually went out and said, okay, what, you know, because they had literally passed this down from mother to daughter, from father to son for 10,000 years. So Robert was telling us a story about the Iroquois Confederacy. And Robert, you want to welcome back to the program, re-inform our listeners about your background and then offer you know, your Tell us your story.
I'm black and Native American. Also, I was one of the major people with Ross Perot, so I got to go on that libertarian thing.
Okay.
But anyway, what happened is basically there's oral traditions that all the things you read in books are stupid and wrong. The settlers came in here, and the first wave had knocked out the Native Americans with the diseases, and they walked into farms and settlements and everything else that were existing.
Yes.
With food growing and everything else.
No, you're right. We knocked them out with flu mostly, actually.
Yeah, but they don't tell you that in history. And the main thing was that they were totally afraid, like I said, with that Chipotle thing and the fear of the wolves coming out of the woods in Europe constantly. Mm. They were constantly afraid of the numbers of the Iroquois Nation and how far back into the middle because they would trade all the way to the Pacific, so they didn't know how many numbers there were.
Right.
So with that particular Albany Plan of Union, they were adapting a lot of the Iroquois' basic political and government system to make them more appeased to not attack them. Or do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, that's interesting, because the Albany Plan of Union was one of the precursors to our Constitution.
Yeah, but I'm telling you, the fear, they were outnumbered tremendously by Native American. They weren't just regular Native Americans. They had brought the chieftains from many nations together at that meeting.
Right.
And so the settlers had to please the Native Americans, but also the point is that everything you know is communism and everything else used the Iroquois Nation system as a basis, and it went all over Europe to the French and everything else, and people don't understand how important that is. And we would occupy Wall Street because the basic thing of the traditions of what you want to see happen because of the Iroquois traditions. And also, Doris Dukes tried to get me to marry her for many years in the 60s, and that's how I started in against this right-wing takeover, because she was preaching that from the 50s and 60s, how these right-wingers were dying out and leaving major fortunes and co-opting even African Americans and putting them through school to do their thing.
Amazing.
And that's how I got involved. And
okay.
I'm still a Republican.
Okay,
Obama.
Thank you. Yeah, I got it. Thank you very much for the story. I appreciate the call and appreciate the story. And the Albany Plan of Union is really an important one. It's worth Googling and checking out. Dee in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Dee. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hello, Tom. I was really interested in your getting input on how to create really a peaceful world. And I think, a lot of what has been said has really taken some of my thoughts. But I think the first major step that we would want to take as a world of true human beings is to declare all people in the world as free.
Yes.
And if we're going to do that, then we all have to have certain investments in each other. And the way we would do that would be through our military, through our infrastructure, through our commerce, and the common good for all people. Mm. I think that all countries in the world should contribute to a world military, and that no matter how large or how small, about commensurate with all other countries. And so that would give everybody an equal footing in.
You're saying so we wouldn't fight against each other.
Run. And that would be the point, is that all people would be involved and participate.
Right. But why not try what, for example, Costa Rica has been doing for the last, I think, about 20 years now, which is having no military at all?
What we would come to realize is we wouldn't need such gigantic militaries, you know?
Well, this was the original battle that led to the Second Amendment to the Constitution. And Jefferson wrote about this at length. Read, Google Jefferson's letters to Madison in 1787. This was when Madison was writing the Constitution, and Jefferson was in Paris. And he was writing to him, and he said, if you don't put in this Constitution a ban on standing armies during time of peace, I will have the Virginia Assembly, blow up the Constitution. And that led to the Second Amendment, which then got modified to strip out the part about no armies during time of peace. Anyhow, don't forget, democracy begins when you show up and participate. Thanks so much for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.